Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, there's a plan to provide Peoria to Chicago passenger rail service. We'll find out more. Coyotes, they're a nuisance to many, and their numbers have been going up in many places. Some have even taken to hunting them. We'll have that story. An ICU nurse tells us what her job's been like during the pandemic.
You know, when we lose a patient, it's very much something that the whole group goes through. And sometimes we just have to take a minute and go back to our break room and cry it out.
Homeowners in Illinois can now have racist language removed from their property records, we'll explain. And vacuum cleaner collectors, yes, they do exist. And they have a convention. We'll take you there. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk about efforts to expand passenger rail service to more of Illinois. Also, a nurse tells us about what her job has been like during the pandemic. And a common household item, well, collectors look at the vacuum cleaner much differently. We'll have those stories and more ahead on Statewide. The number of coyotes has grown in most of the Midwest in the past few decades, and they're largely unwelcome around homes and farms. One response has been to hunt them, sometimes competitively. But as David Kondos with the Kansas News Service reports, the resilient canine keeps finding ways to survive no matter what humans throw at it. And as a warning, the story contains the sound of gunfire and depictions of hunting animals.
Brian Garrison is here. You just can't really see him. As the morning light creeps across this pasture, he sits motionless, covered in camo, reclining on a cushion next to a sagebrush. It's opening day of the Southwest Kansas Coyote Calling Contest in Kismet, and Garrison, his son, and a friend are competing with other teams to see who can call in and shoot the most coyotes, or coyotes as folks pronounce it around here. So with a shotgun in one hand and a remote in the other, he plays the role of DJ, spinning some of the coyote calling world's greatest hits.
Here's a raccoon pup distress. Cottontail female coyote challenge.
After about 15 minutes, there's a flash of gray 40 yards ahead. Garrison fires twice, but misses. The coyote disappears back into the brush.
It's fun because it's hard. You don't turn on a call and every coyote in the country come running to you.
Calling contests mark just the latest chapter in a centuries-long war between humans and coyotes, as both species expand their range across the continent. And the coyotes are winning. Intelligent, resilient, and extremely adaptable, coyotes have thrived, even as many other American mammals have declined or disappeared since European settlement. Cutting down forests just gave them more habitat. Exterminating wolves removed their chief rival. Now, they're the most common large predator in the country. So coyote callers figure that for every one they bring in, that's one less potential threat to livestock out on the range. The next afternoon, teams line up coyote carcasses by the dozen on the grass behind City Hall.
53.2.
They're counted, weighed, and remember, it's a competition. So to guard against cheating, kitchen thermometers measure if the bodies are still warm. Then they're checked for the right amount of rigor mortis. Finally comes James Kelly, a retired cop, the lie detector guy. He's strapped thousands of hunters to his polygraph over the years, many who have tried to break contest rules. But he says his special recipe of detailed questions sniffs out the cheats.
The way that we ask the questions are more along the lines of a criminal act than just a generic, we're just going to do polygraph for the heck of it. We're not doing polygraph for the heck of it. We're doing it for a specific goal to make sure that people aren't cheating.
On this night, the winners pass the test. Altogether, the teams bring in a total of 83 coyotes. And that's just a drop in the bucket. Americans kill roughly 500,000 coyotes each year. But coyote populations, well, they just keep getting stronger. Here's Kansas State University wildlife specialist Drew Ricketts.
People always talk about how if there's a nuclear war or whatever, there's going to be cockroaches and rats left, and I always throw coyotes into that.
Coyotes have expanded their territory by 40% since the 1950s, from the Alaskan tundra to the Florida coast to downtown Chicago. And all the while, humans have been trying to kill them, infecting them with diseases, tossing poisoned baits from snowmobiles, shooting them down from helicopters.
Coyote, coyote.
But coyotes have shown an uncanny knack for survival. They can live anywhere, eat almost anything. And Rickett says that when a bunch of coyotes are killed, the others just have bigger litters to make up for it.
The reasons that broad-scale population control of coyotes doesn't work all that well, those are also the reasons that make calling competitions sustainable.
Meanwhile, coyote attacks continue to cost the Kansas cattle industry an estimated $4 million a year. A few years ago, they dragged off some of Bob Davies' calves at his ranch near Kismet.
Yeah, it's right across the river over here.
His response? Renaming that piece of land Coyote Pasture. After dealing with these wily canines for decades, he knows what he's up against. It's the coyotes' world now. We just live in it.
They're going to survive, you know, no matter what we do. They're going to be around forever.
In Kismet, Kansas, I'm David Kontos.
Where will you run?
Peoria leaders have unveiled a proposed passenger rail service concept that would link the River City to Chicago. Tim Shelley has more on that plan.
The Illinois Department of Transportation's feasibility study for Peoria passenger rail service is still in the works. City Manager Patrick Urich says it's an update of previous studies conducted in 2011 and 2013.
The effort is to try and gather some of that data and background information to use to update that, to take a look at the proposed route. But in addition, to work on the public engagement side, to work on the survey that you see that Councilman Ruckriegel just mentioned, as well as to coordinate with stakeholders like the city and the working group that we have. And that goal is to have that study completed by April. So the route that we're looking at is as you see up here on the screen, it follows the route of the old Rock Island Rocket Line, which would take Peoria north along the Illinois River up to La Salle, Peru, in through Ottawa, and then Morris into Joliet, and then into Chicago. So this route is the route that we're looking at. It's the route that we're trying to examine. What it also does, obviously, in addition to opening up Peoria to passenger rail, it opens up those communities of La Salle, Peru, Ottawa, and Morris that currently don't have passenger rail access as well. So that's the current route that we're looking at.
The proposed route wouldn't require any additional land acquisition, but would require rail upgrades. The drive to land passenger rail service in Peoria is a long-stated goal of Mayor Rita Ali.
Peoria is the largest metropolitan area in the state without passenger rail. A little over 6 months ago, I teamed up with former United States Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, and we agreed to work together to bring high-speed passenger rail to Peoria. And when I say high-speed, technically, high speed is about 200 miles per hour, and nobody in the U.S. has that. So we're looking at higher speed passenger rail, at least around 79, 80 miles per hour. Passenger rail that could get us from here to Chicago in a couple hours.
Ali describes the next steps in the process.
The development of an initial case statement that helps to justify the case for bringing fast, frequent, and affordable trains to and from Peoria. A vetting process that has resulted in the selection of a proposed train route. IDOT's awarding of a contract with Patrick Engineering, the consultant firm that will actually handle and conduct the feasibility study, which actually started in December and is expected to conclude in April. The arrangement of meetings with top leaders of Amtrak and the FRA, which is the Federal Railroad Administration, in Washington, D.C. And today's launch of a public survey to gauge interest and engage with the local community. We are making progress and gaining momentum. There's no time like now that we can tap into new federal and state funding and resources to make this a reality for Peoria.
At-large City Councilman Sid Ruckriegel says he's heard about passenger rail demand from Peoria residents since he moved here in 1992.
where we are at this point has been through a lot of hours, a lot of hard work, and we're on a very short time frame. You know, I think about the fact that rail, what does it mean for our area? It means economics. It means tourism. And it means quality of life. And really, when you really think what rail could add to our area as another mode of transportation, it not only makes sense, it really makes dollars to our community.
Peoria Area Convention and Visitors Bureau President and CEO J.D. D'Alfonso says a passenger rail link through Starved Rock Country to Chicago would also be a boon to tourism in Peoria.
We have a rich destination as a true economic driver. And prior to the pandemic hitting, I like to remind people of the strong economic status we were from a tourism standpoint of generating over more than $686 million in domestic travel tourism spending to the region. And that's a large number that we're creeping back as we recover from COVID. And the more access we have for visitors and residents alike to access Central Illinois, the better it is for that economic driver moving forward. And many of us in this conversation can think about how rail can benefit our residents here. But from our standpoint, we're also thinking of the visitors along this route, LaSalle, Peru, Ottawa, Morris, Joliet, and Chicago, to access Peoria and Central Illinois all the same. So we could be using this to get to those destinations, but many of the residents along this route can access Peoria as well through this new and what I call a safe and convenient way of travel, whether that's traveling with kids or retired or any lifestyle and socioeconomic status, they can access our great River City through this route.
A separate study will look at potential sites for a railroad station in downtown Peoria along the riverfront. I'm Tim Shelley.
You can find a map of the proposed Peoria to Chicago route and more information about the passenger rail study. We have a link at our website. Just go to nprillinois.org. Look for Statewide. A Rockford teenager who has a passion for storytelling is now able to use her love to inspire other young people in her community. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
Sunshine melted away at my face.
Auburn High School junior Juliana Gamero was recently appointed the second Youth Poet Laureate for the city of Rockford. She says she had no idea the position existed until her AP seminar teacher encouraged her to apply. She says despite her personality, she decided to go for it.
I still am kind of shy, introverted, but he asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said, you know, I don't know the odds of it, but I'll do it anyways, because, you know, might be the only chance I get to.
Gamero says she fell in love with creative writing in first grade, but she didn't start dating poetry until middle school.
We were doing a poetry unit and I heard slam poetry for the first time. And it made my heart absolutely swell with joy.
She also makes time for writing science fiction and fantasy.
I was never a, you know, typical, like, I only want princesses and gowns and things like that. You know, I like to explore everything. I was a princess, but I was a dragon fighting princess.
Her works have been published in the Young American Poetry Digest, and she also has an honorable mention with the National Scholastic Art and Writing Award.
I've popped my lips out at the sky, my tiny smile flying high, and all in all, I was an abortion reminiscent of life.
Gamero wants to reach now, deep inside the hearts of young children during her term.
I really would love to visit schools and start instilling like the love of poetry at a developmental age. So essentially from kindergarten throughout high school, like, and that's it covers all the bases.
She says this is important because she remembers not being able to verbalize her feelings and how writing helped her get those thoughts out. Gamero says she's written over 100 poems. She has yet to recite any of her works in front of an audience, but says she's ready for the challenge.
I am a very awkward, anxious person, and I never thought that I would ever be able to have such a big platform like this to spread my passions. And even thinking about it, like, I'm still in shock.
Gamero says her passion for healing the world through poetry outweighs her anxiety.
Wholeheartedly, my goal in life is to share my love, whether it's poetry, art, music, film, no matter what it is. I just want to make the world a place where love can flourish and passions can thrive, even in the midst of very, very dark situations.
She envisions starting an all-city spoken word poetry event. She wants it to be a space where people can learn more about poetry. Gamero expresses the importance of studying other poets. She says her favorite poet is Sylvia Plath. Other favorites include Langston Hughes and Emily Dickinson. Gamero will facilitate workshops and take part in other community events during her one-year term. She takes over from Rockford's first Youth Poet Laureate, Jocelyn Kuntz. The Youth Poet Laureate position is made possible by a collaboration between the Rockford Area Arts Council, the Rockford Public Library, and the City of Rockford. The award ceremony takes place January 31st at Rockford City Hall.
Lacking when clashing in battle, the
Anya bomb
we strap on were fashioned by man. I still think myself owning a fetal heart. It is something about the genesis of anew that gets the blood rushing, the thoughts racing, and all the spinally fibrous bits of...
Illinois school workers could soon get relief for days they took off for COVID-related reasons, but they'll need to be vaccinated to get those benefits, as Susie Ahn explains.
Governor J.B. Pritzker vetoed a bill that educators widely supported, but he came to an agreement with the state's teachers union on a new plan. Like the old bill, the new proposal calls for paid administrative leave and restoration of sick days for time off related to COVID, including quarantining and caring for a sick child. But in the latest plan, only vaccinated staff qualify. The proposal also guarantees full pay to hourly workers who are forced to miss work because of COVID-related school closures or e-learning days. The proposal needs to be introduced and passed by lawmakers in Springfield. The previous bill passed by a wide margin. I'm Susie Ahn.
You're listening to Statewide. We'll be back with more in a moment. And welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. History teachers scrambled to explain January 6th to their students last year. Since then, Peter Medlin reports on how teachers have embedded lessons on that day into their curriculum.
On January 6, 2022, Lucas Clevenger asked his history class, "What day is it?" It took him a little bit, but eventually they realized it had been a year since the attack on the Capitol. Student teacher Elena Earlywine went deeper. Do they remember why the extremist mob was there in the first place?
After some digging, they did remember why they were there. It had something to do with the election.
Clevenger's class went back and watched the same clips of the mob storm in the Capitol that they'd seen a year earlier.
Looking at how different news organizations were portraying it, spinning that it was pro-Trump demonstrators, it was Antifa, infiltrating in, things like that, and just how from hours after that narrative was already changing and how it's changed over the course of this year.
Teachers like Clevenger try to point it out so students don't get caught up in misinformation meant to muddle what actually happened that day. U.S. government teacher Nicole Frazier says that January 6th is far from the only day history and government classes talk about January 6th. That's because the lessons extend to so many areas they already teach. It fits in with elections, the Civil War, the powers of the executive. It certainly helps teach about concepts that used to be abstract for students like the Electoral College.
It's like, oh, okay, I can bring this in because we're talking about voter rights and voter protection and kind of what does the Constitution say about voting? Well, this is how January 6th and kind of the arguments around it connect into that as well.
January 6th fits nicely into their current unit on politics and power.
It's about tracing how this didn't come out of nowhere, that we need to understand how this movement grows and how it reflects other parts of history.
Clevenger asks his students, who has power? How do they maintain it? And what happens when they're asked to give it up?
We framed it in the events of other things like Tulsa riots in the early 1900s. And this is not the first event of this magnitude. It's the first one to challenge in D.C., but it's not the first, massive white supremacist movement that we've seen, even in the modern day with Charlottesville and things like that.
Clevenger says that January 6th was obviously shocking, but after his students traced the roots of the movement and former President Trump's baseless fraud claims leading up to the 2020 election, many say that it's not that surprising. Emma Carmona is a senior in his class.
I definitely feel like something like this could possibly happen again in the future. I feel like this could possibly like resurface once the 2024 elections do come about.
It's one of the reasons that at the beginning of each school year, Clevenger asks his students, why do we learn history?
Because I get a lot of the, it's boring, how does this help me run a business, things like that. And it's understanding a lot of kids came up with this that, you know, if you don't realize that you're doomed to repeat it. And so by continuing these conversations, you're going to try and prevent the next event that is like this.
And since the causes and ramifications of January 6th intersect with so many issues in their classes, conversations about the attempted insurrection aren't going anywhere.
By minimizing our discussion or removing it entirely, we fail to realize that teaching is political. And the importance of this event and events like it have to be talked about, because once they're brushed aside, they're allowed to happen again.
The fallout of the pro-Trump mob's attack continues. Hearings on it are still being held. And Clevenger and Frazier want to make sure their students have the tools to understand the impact of that day. I'm Peter Medlin.
An Illinois lawmaker is introducing a plan to require state schools to teach Native American history. It instructs the State Board of Education to develop a unit covering the Native American experience and contributions in collaboration with tribes from Illinois and the Midwest. Representative Maurice West, a Democrat from Rockford, says the measure grew out of a stalled effort to reform Native American mascots at schools.
The bipartisanship wasn't really there when it came to mascots, not just yet. So let me focus on what is being taught in schools for Native American, for the Native American community, so that we can then have those conversations within a lens of sensitivity and temperance and tolerance.
A similar bill requiring Illinois schools to teach Asian American history became law last year. For a small fee, Illinois property owners can remove racist language from their property records. Natalie Moore of WBEZ has this report.
When Munden Line resident Nicole Sullivan wanted to install a dog fence, she contacted the Homeowners Association. In the process of paperwork, she learned that a land covenant prohibited the selling, transferring, or leasing of her property to, quote, persons of the African or Negro, Japanese, Chinese, Jewish, or Hebrew races, or their descendants. Only as servants could they live there. The 1968 Fair Housing Act makes that illegal today. Still, Sullivan wanted the language removed, but doing so would require cutting through a lot of red tape. Sullivan's home is among 400 in a subdivision that all have the same language.
What we had been told is that you would have to have 100% of property owners not only agree to it, but kind of go through this lengthy and expensive legal process.
However, a new Illinois law is now in effect that allows property owners to go to their local county recorder to get rid of the racist language in a swift and streamlined way. Sullivan is one of the first people to seek removal in Lake County.
This is a document that continues to harm people. It continues to psychologically damage people and damage relationships and trust in our community.
Sullivan is seeking to not only remove the covenant on her property, but for all the homes in her subdivision.
Our neighborhood is still predominantly white. There isn't a ton of diversity in our neighborhood, and I don't think that's by accident. Our neighborhood has generations of the same families that live here. People who are in their 80s now that have lived here their entire lives, and their parents lived here before that. This legacy from this segregation is still here.
Like I said, the covenants are no longer legal, but they still exist on deeds and records all over Chicago and in the region. They are a potent reminder of racism, segregation, and exclusionary practices of home ownership that mostly affected African Americans. Sullivan and some of her neighbors asked State Senator Adrian Johnson to write legislation to do something about the relics.
It was just a need of another way of kind of righting the wrongs from the past, even though the racial restrictive covenants are unenforceable, a reminder of, you know, a stain on our history.
A few months ago, WBEZ asked the public to search their property records and upload any that contained restrictive deeds or covenants. Jim Koppensteiner in suburban Niles heard that story. On a lark, he decided to check the house he grew up in where his mother still lives and found this clause. Said premises shall not be conveyed or leased to or occupied by any persons who is not a Caucasian. Servants excluded. Koppensteiner says he was disappointed and disgusted. He asked his mother if she knew about the deed. She says she didn't, but agreed to have it removed. But his late father signed it.
My dad was pretty meticulous in everything he did. I gotta believe he did know.
Koppensteiner says feelings are complicated because 1967, the year his parents bought the home, was in the thick of the civil rights movement, a time when he'd like to think his father would be more thoughtful about racial issues.
I wish I could sit here and tell you that my dad was that one guy who said to the builder, you know, take your deed and shove it up your ass. He wasn't.
Koppensteiner sees his father as being reflective of commonly held views and sentiments during racist times.
At least I wasn't going to settle for that. I was going to open my eyes to it.
Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
To have the language removed from a property record, you can contact the person who records deeds for your county. Chicago's population grew slightly over the last decade, according to census figures, but a closer look shows the growth has been uneven. Most of the growth was on the north side or near downtown in majority white neighborhoods. That has also brought economic development and jobs. In majority black communities, the opposite is true. Esther Yunji King examines what's behind the disparity.
I'm standing here on the corner of Randolph and Ogden on Chicago's Near West Side. I look up and there's a 20-plus story building going up here. Just across the street, more construction on a new parking garage. As I head east, I pass by a lot of people walking and talking into their earpieces. Plenty of joggers, toddlers from three different daycares walking at a snail's pace with their teachers. Just outside a swanky bakery in what's known as Chicago's Restaurant Row, I meet Sari Schwartz. She's originally from the suburbs, but moved into the city after 6 years in California.
I just felt like when I moved back to Chicago, I just wanted something a little different, and I felt like West Loop was kind of an up-and-coming new neighborhood, so I thought it'd be cool.
Atop her list of what she wanted in a neighborhood?
Just looking for an area with more restaurants, retail shops, coffee shops, places like that.
And the Near West Side has plenty of that. The next day, I'm a couple of miles over, east and south, in the Near South Side. It's much quieter than the Near West Side, but there are plenty of people pushing strollers and walking their dogs. I meet Tony Chan outside the high-rise building where he and his wife have lived for the past 5 years. He says they love the Near South Side.
We're by the lake. We're 10, 15-minute walk away. There's a lot of green space. We're close to downtown. It almost feels like we're in the middle of the city. We're intersected by all the major highways, 55, 290, 9094, and so on.
Chan grew up in Bridgeport, near Chinatown, and had his eye on the Near South Side.
I've seen this area just explode in terms of development and people living here and people moving here.
He's right. The area where he lives is booming, much like the Near West Side. In fact, a look at new 2020 census data shows these two neighborhoods, along with a handful of others mostly on the north side, accounted for nearly all the population growth in Chicago since 2010. WBEZ crunched some numbers and found that it's these areas where people, namely white residents, some Asians, are flocking to. The opposite is true for most majority black neighborhoods. We also looked at other growth markers, jobs, new construction, new businesses. And we found that majority white communities collectively experienced the highest growth in all three, while black communities saw the least growth.
Real estate investment is about return on investment.
That's Mike Moravec. He's with the John Buck Company, a real estate investment and development firm.
The investors are looking for a return on their investment, and a growth area represents a positive situation where that return is more likely. To acquire a site where there is no growth is not worth the investment. And so, you know, people don't, or investors don't want to go there.
One big area the firm's invested in recently is the Near West Side. Moravec says for developers to go to the city's majority black neighborhoods, there need to be public-private partnerships. I ask him what that would look like.
You know, I don't have all the answers to this very difficult challenge. You know, perhaps there's some land that the city could contribute at a very low cost basis, perhaps.
Like developers, businesses too are looking for a return on investment. A few months ago, I was on the Near West Side for the opening of Dispensary 33, a medical and recreational cannabis shop. An employee showed me around the beautiful industrial space with wood beam ceilings and display cases of neatly arranged weed products.
So these are all of our edible tables, and they're organized by type. So we have chocolates over here, gummies.
I met Paul Lee, one of the owners of the dispensary, which opened its first location in Andersonville on the north side in 2015. When Lee and his partners were looking to open their second shop, the Near West Side was a no-brainer.
This is just a nicer area where they've done a lot of construction, business building, and it's now an area where it's desirable to live.
Business owners, developers, and residents all want the same stuff: convenience, amenities, retail, and restaurants. No one I spoke to mentioned race explicitly, but some say it's inextricable from all the other factors.
Race is a big factor in the growth and development and revitalization in Chicago communities. It's a big factor that many people do not want to acknowledge.
That's urban planner Pete Saunders. He says race affects all the building blocks that make up growth: the institutions, the businesses, the people. And each of them are making choices that are leaving black communities in the lurch.
There is a resistance to investing in black neighborhoods that's passed on from generation to generation. It lives on beyond the old redlining days from the 1930s and forward.
Jacqueline Huang teaches sociology at Stanford University. She studies how neighborhoods change in U.S. cities and how that's related to racial segregation. She says the lens through which people see neighborhoods matters.
We know from research on neighborhood preferences that there's a lot of bias in how people view neighborhoods, and discrimination in preferences as well, especially in a city like Chicago, which is hyper-segregated.
Huang says in a capitalist society, it only makes sense that developers, investors, and businesses will build and set up shop where they expect to see profit. So who bears the responsibility for inequitable growth?
I think it's really on policymakers to promote investment in other places, create more equitable growth, equal quality of life across neighborhoods.
Huang says having strong policies that keep housing affordable and allowing for participatory planning of neighborhoods will lead to more equitable growth. Nidra Sims Fears heads the Greater Chatham Initiative, which promotes economic growth in Chatham and other majority black Southside neighborhoods. Those areas have not seen the same boom as their North and Northwest Side counterparts. Sims Fears has some words for developers and businesses relying on incentives from the city to bring construction and jobs to black neighborhoods.
They need to get off the city of Chicago welfare. It just blows my mind that we have to pay them to come to our community. Either they want us as customers or they don't.
She says it's a vicious cycle. The private sector doesn't invest in black neighborhoods, and so black residents leave the city. Developers and businesses then neglect the neighborhoods that are left behind, and so on and so forth.
Don't tell me about loss in population when I can't give people how they want to live because you won't build the housing in our community. So you just talk in circles.
Still, Sims Fears is hopeful. She thinks the conversations on race and equity spurred in recent years will lead to change. She hopes all of Chicago, not just its white neighborhoods and the areas near downtown, will grow and thrive in coming years.
Esther Yoon-Chi King with that report from Chicago. Stay with us, more of Statewide to come. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and still ahead, we'll talk with a nurse about what it's been like to work during the pandemic. Well, during the recent surge in COVID cases, there have been a lot of questions about monoclonal antibodies, which are used to prevent and treat infection from the coronavirus. Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper spoke with Dr. Myron Cohen, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
How are these antibodies made and how are they administered?
When people recover from an infection, they, as the host of the infection, have made antibodies to try and get rid of the infection. So if we take people who've recovered from COVID, whatever the variant, we can get their blood and look in their blood to see how well their blood neutralizes the virus. And we know if it neutralizes the virus, the variant we're interested in, we can then look for the B cell that made the best antibody in their blood. So we're looking for people who are making super duper antibodies. And we search many, many thousands of people to find those who make the very best antibodies. We harvest a single cell that made the very best antibody. Then we make sure that cell can replicate in a test tube. Once the cell replicates in a test tube, you've got what's called a clone of cells. You can make any number of those cells, and they're going to make the antibody you want. The most important way to avoid becoming ill is to get two doses of an mRNA vaccine followed by a third dose a few months later. That gives you your own antibodies, but not everybody's vaccinated. And some people who are vaccinated don't respond to the vaccines properly, especially those receiving cancer therapies or immune therapies. And we know for sure that the thing that works against you in this kind of lottery of doing bad is age and other comorbidities. And so for people in whom we suspect progression of disease, which means you might get sick enough to be hospitalized, we would want to prevent progression of disease.
Is this something that you're administering after someone has been infected, or is the idea to give monoclonal antibodies before someone gets infected with the virus?
You can do either thing. For people who either have not been vaccinated or cannot respond to a vaccine, who we think have been exposed or will be exposed, we can do pre- or post-exposure prophylaxis. That's also called passive immunity. It's a very old idea. But as Omicron has surfaced, it's limited the number that are appropriate. And right now, the most appropriate is a drug called sotrovimab. It's in short supply, so it's somewhat rationed. For prevention, we have Evusheld. So sotrovimab is approved for treatment. Evusheld is approved for prevention.
Some people may have this thought of, well, there's treatment now. I'll just rely on that instead of getting a vaccine.
Let there be no mistake about this. Even if we get super duper treatments, they're only 80% effective. We don't know whether they're going to have any effect on long COVID, that is persistent cough and headache and symptoms that might last for months. And they have to be given very quickly. You have to go out and get a test in order to qualify. So what you want to do is not get the infection. And the way to not get the infection is pretty straightforward. Behavioral changes. Try and avoid situations where you're indoors crowded with people and not wearing a mask. Number two, get vaccinated. It doesn't necessarily mean you won't get a breakthrough infection. And this is something people don't understand. These vaccines were never really designed to completely prevent infection. They were designed to prevent you from progression of disease that would lead to hospitalization and ICU stay.
That's Dr. Myron Cohen of UNC Chapel Hill. He was speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper. Well, the pandemic has put a strain on the healthcare system and especially on nurses. Sarah Nardi with WGLT has been speaking with nurses about their experiences. She talked with Stephanie Fuller, who's a charge nurse at the ICU at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. She's been a nurse since 2004, but says the past 2 years have been unlike anything she's experienced before.
Wow, it's been a whirlwind, that's for sure. It's hard to sum it up, but it has been hard. It has made us reflect on just our own lives and the lives of others. It's really put us to the test. And I think, you know, the work aside, the most remarkable thing is the way we've come together as a team and the way myself and my coworkers support each other and get each other through the hard days. And it's just something you don't see every day. And I'm honored to be a part of it.
I spoke to a nurse at OSF who said that she and her fellow nurses have developed kind of this informal grieving process when they lose patients, because that's what's getting them through right now. Do you have similar experiences at Carle?
Yeah, you know, when we lose a patient, it's very much something that the whole group goes through. And sometimes we just have to take a minute and go back to our break room and cry it out. We've done a lot of that. We check on each other before and after work. We try to be mindful of what each other's going through. We use the chaplains as much as we can. The power of prayer has been huge for us. There's good days and bad days, and we take the wins and we celebrate them, and the losses, we take care of each other. We're a family.
So there are good days and bad days. On balance, have they been better or worse lately?
Every day has its unique challenges. I would say it's a little better right now. We've had a lot going on, and with this new strain of COVID, there's certainly a lot more patients, but I think the outcomes have been better. People are out there getting their vaccines, and, you know, we're having a lot more wins.
That's good to hear. I think some of the prevailing wisdom in the community, not just here, but everywhere, is that, you know, Omicron is mild. It seems to be causing less serious disease. And so kind of a little bit of a throw caution to the wind attitude. Is that what you see on the ground in the ICU? Do you see milder instantiations of COVID?
I wouldn't say milder, definitely. I think we are seeing a much larger volume of patients. The spread of the Omicron variant has been massive. And those patients are coming in just as sick. The only difference I would see is that they're getting better a little bit faster, and their recovery has been just a tiny bit shorter, but it's still just as dangerous as all the other variants.
Is there a notable difference between patients who have been vaccinated versus those that haven't in terms of outcome right now?
Absolutely. I cannot stress that enough. I can't remember the last time we lost a patient that was vaccinated. I know the vaccine is very scary for some people, and I totally get that, but it is saving lives, and we're seeing that every single day. Those that do get COVID that did have the vaccine, they're recovering much faster, and they're walking out of that hospital, and I think that says it all.
We hear a lot about burnout among medical professionals. How are you doing? How are your coworkers doing?
It's been tough. It's really made you question your career choice at times. But at the end of the day, this is what we've all trained for. We've worked for this. We went to school for this, and we have a passion for this. So now it's game time, so to speak. And it's our time to do what we've always wanted to do. And that's to help people and to save lives and to be there for the community.
Do you ever experience any element of frustration knowing that the vaccines do help and they do prevent dire outcomes in a lot of people? Is it frustrating for you that some people aren't taking that step?
It's not so much frustration as it is just complete sadness. When you look around and you see so many patients, how their paths could have been different had they gotten the vaccine. And my heart goes out to them, and I just wish they had made a different choice. But with that being said, I am totally there to support them and be by their side as much as we possibly can and get them through it. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're all human and we're a community. And the beautiful thing about America is you do have the freedom of choice. So I support that and I respect that. I just wish you'd get the vaccine though.
Yeah, it's a fine line to walk for some reason. I get that.
Yes.
So with that dedication, you work 3 12-hour shifts a week, and I imagine that it's intense. When you go home at the end of the shift, are you able to leave work behind, or is that something you carry with you?
Sometimes I do bring it home, and I can say often, you know, I'm bringing home the exhaustion and just the total mental drain. I used to hate my 30-minute drive home, and now I'm so appreciative of it because I get that windshield time that my mom calls it. I can sit there and reflect on patients that didn't do so well, and I can celebrate for the patients that had a win.
Do you see any hope, any light at the end of the tunnel right now?
right now it's hard to see that light. I'd like to think it's coming one of these days. I'm just going to keep hoping and praying that the end is near.
That's Nurse Stephanie Fuller with Carl Broman in Normal. Fuller says when times are tough, she thinks about patients who need her, and that keeps her going. She spoke with Sarah Nardi. While most people consider vacuum cleaners to be just a household tool, for a select group of enthusiasts, they are a passion. Last year, Jonathan All attended the 15th annual National Vacuum Cleaner Collectors Club convention, and he took us along.
That sound may make you think of housework. After all, a vacuum cleaner's job is to clean. But to Mike Arrigo of St. Louis, it's music.
Each one has a different pitch, and yeah, it does kind of create an image. I actually have one vacuum, which I actually did bring with me. It brings back memories because it sounds exactly like the first wet-dry vac we ever had when I was a kid. It's an E-flat note.
Arrigo is a vacuum cleaner collector. He's also blind, but he enjoys the sound of these humble appliances so much that he came to Rolla, along with more than 50 other people from as far away as New York and California, to the Vacuum Cleaner Collectors Club convention. It's held at Mid-Missouri Vacuum, a repair shop and museum in an unassuming strip mall in Rolla. Alex Terzuola came from Denver and said the shop is the Taj Mahal of vacuum collections.
This beautiful display here, it's really worth visiting and seeing everything lined up just perfect and everything you can go through, like it's like a time capsule for different decades.
The owner of the shop is Tom Gasco. He has more than 700 vacuum cleaners, the best of which are on display in his shop. Gasco is one of the top two collectors in the country, and yes, there is debate in the vacuum cleaner collector community on whose is the best. Gasco says he has been obsessed with vacuums since he was a kid, and says they tell the story of art and culture and society since their invention around 1900.
The machines that were made in the 1930s, as an example, are all Art Deco. In the 1940s, especially right after World War II, when we had a national steel strike, steel was very, very hard to get. But a new plastic had been invented called Bakelite. So you begin to see Bakelite vacuum cleaners made after World War II.
All right, so we'll run this one.
One of the highlights of the convention is getting to try out the vacuums, both the ones in Gasco's museum and the ones collectors bring to show off. Stephen Norris of Knoxville, Tennessee, is running a 1968 Kirby right after he took a 1968 Hoover for a test drive.
I think it's easier to steer around furniture than the Hoover to me, but it doesn't go as low underneath that furniture.
Norris says he loves vacuums, but it's hard for him to describe why. He says he's been interested in them since he was a kid.
Get whatever you want for your birthday, and then I would get a vacuum for my birthday, and I guess it goes from there. So there's not a concrete answer, to, if you know what I mean, on why. I think it's something you're born into is how I always think of it. So,
in addition to trying out vacuums and talking about their shared passion, this community also works to help each other. Charlie Waltress of North Carolina has been working for years to try to get a 1946 Premier upright working again. He thought a repairman he had worked with before could help.
He looked at it and he said, you know, there's not a lot I can do. It's more going to be like a display vacuum. Then I took it to a local place where I live in North Carolina, and it was sort of the same thing. We can't do anything, and it's like, I just refuse to accept that.
So Waltress brought the vacuum to Rolla, where a collector brought a motor he could have, and Michael Balda of Wisconsin worked on it for hours. Balda, who has had some of his vacuums used as props in movies, says the Premier might be the hardest vacuum to fix.
This style vac is a hard one to take apart. It was engineered to last forever, so you know it's 80 years old, and when we're done with it, it'll still be running it today. So.
That's awesome. I'm glad you got it working.
That's an all-day project.
Was there ever any doubt that you were going to get it working?
Getting it working. No, getting it back together, yeah.
Gasco says that sense of community may be what this convention is really about.
So it is a 50% vacuum-oriented thing, but we really enjoy getting together once a year, and for some people, it's their vacation.
But don't be mistaken. They really love vacuum cleaners. Gasco has a tattoo of the logo of his favorite vacuum, the 1935 Airway, on his arm. and has made it clear that when he dies, he wants to be cremated and have his ashes vacuumed up in one. In Rolla, I'm Jonathan All.
Well, that's it for this week statewide. Thanks for being with us, and join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our shows available at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide, and also our statewide podcast available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.